So you mentioned to start out that you are getting close to year two of Gallup Purdue. It's something that has been talked about a lot around here. It's been talked about a lot nationally. Any changes from year one to year two that we're going to notice?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, we have been consistent in asking some of the same key outcome measures that we did in the first year, getting at whether graduates are engaged in their work, thriving in their well-being, asking questions about household and personal income. So those are all things that are going to be consistent. We have added new questions, so new areas of research inquiry about additional college experiences that we theoretically believe might have a relationship with these long-term outcomes and testing that. Expanded questions for veterans who are college graduates, a whole in-depth set of questions about student loan debt and its relationship to things like buying a home or a car or getting married or having children or starting your own business. So an in-depth look at student loan debt and its relationship to a whole bunch of other things. So definitely some new findings, but the real beauty of this is that now we have a data set that has grown from 30,000 college graduates to 60,000. And so where we couldn't do analysis on specific demographic cuts that were rather small in terms of the incidence rate, we now have the ability to report on. So we're going to be doing big reports on minority college graduates, a population that, you know, we had less data on last year and now have an incredibly large data set to work with. So, you know, you'll see us being able to do more breaks between white college graduates, Hispanic, black, Asian college graduates, which we didn't do a lot of, you know, kind of breakout analysis on in the first year. So a lot of exciting stuff like that.
How do you determine what numbers and what outcomes are actually important? It seems like we're still kind of in the throw the dart at the board and see if there's a connection phase.
Well, I mean, you know, let's kind of distinguish between outcomes after college and experiences in college, because we've been trying to look at both of those and specifically trying to look at what relationships exist between experiences you had or didn't have in college and whether that had a relationship with your, you know, success later in life or work, right? So, you know, when we think about outcomes before the Gallup Purdue study, there honestly was only one thing that we knew about the outcome of a college degree, and that was that you make a lot more money over your lifetime than people who don't get a college degree. So that's still a true statement, and it's an important statement, but what we've been trying to do in this effort is get at other outcomes that we actually do know matter, right? So through the lens of measuring whether people are engaged in their work, the reason why that matters is that Gallup has been able to show that engaged employees are more productive. They're less likely to be absent. They have lower turnover rates. They have lower safety incidents at work. They have a lower healthcare cost burden, right? They actually generate more revenue and profit if they're in a for-profit company. So it's not only a nice thing to know that people are more engaged, more emotionally engaged in their work, it's also linked to very real outcomes. And the same thing with well-being. It sounds like a nice thing to measure, but we've also shown that people who are more likely to be thriving in their well-being have a lower healthcare cost burden than employees who are not, as an example, right? So so those are examples of the, you know, Gallup research constructs that are in the study that are important. But we also asked simple questions this year that I think a lot of people would say would matter. We asked a direct question, whether you thought your education was worth the cost. And, you know, in this day and age, when people are carefully evaluating, you know, the dollars invested relative to the outcome they're getting, I think a question like that is a very fair question to ask. I think it's one that matters.
At the same time, though, that question is super subjective, because everyone will measure it in a different way. And doesn't that skew the results because there's no measuring stick that everybody's using?
Well, I think it's simple. I mean, everybody only has one degree to measure, right? So it's not like you've sampled Coke and Pepsi and you've been asked to determine which one you like the taste of better. I have one bachelor's degree. Maybe there's a handful of people who got two bachelor's degrees from different institutions, but most of us just have a degree, and we either feel that it was worth it or we don't. And so, you know, not to spoil some of the findings of the year two national study, but there's a difference in how people feel about that question based on how much student debt they racked up. There's a difference in how people feel about that question based on the quality experiences they had in college or not, right? So we actually think, and a lot of Gallup research has shown that, you know, how people feel about things, how they rate their lives, how they actually – their emotion that they have about things is actually a very important measure. I mean, we can ask them how much money they make. It's another thing to ask them whether they've worried about money in the last week. And what we found is that on some of these kind of behavioral economic questions that, you know, some people I think are more subjective in nature, they actually matter a lot to a lot of important outcomes. So certainly understand and appreciate your question, but I would also argue that those kinds of questions are really important ones to keep asking. I would never rate a university solely on, you know, how many graduates feel their education was worth the cost, but I do think it's an important question to throw in the mix. And, you know, it's an interesting one because far fewer college graduates strongly agree with that question than we thought we would see. So that's going to be one of the findings that comes out.
You mentioned the money example, and asking someone how much money you make is in fact very different than asking, did you worry about money in the last week? And the second question would seem to be one that gets more at the heart of things. On the other hand, it talks a lot more about the external factors. Someone can make $1 million a year, and if they're living too close to their means, maybe they are worrying more about money in the last week than somebody who makes $35,000 a year. How do you strip away the other outside factors and the other behavioral characteristics of a person that might influence their answers to these questions?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, you can't fully, you know, account for all those things the way you've asked that question. But I'll give you an example. One of the things we've learned in our worldwide well-being research is that, for example, how you evaluate your life. Ask people questions about, you know, how do they evaluate their life on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best imaginable life, you know, 1 being the worst. How do you rate your life, right? It's just a, you know, the only person who's a judge of that question is you yourself, right? I can't tell you how you feel about that. You have to tell me how you feel about it. Here's the point, you know, when we look at well-being, there's not really a relationship to income and well-being after $75,000 a year in annual income. Up to $75,000 a year, it matters, right? After that, there's really kind of no real return, if you will, on well-being relative to income. But it's more about the relationship people have with money that's important. So I'll give you an example. It's not necessarily how much money you make, but people who spend their money on experiences have higher well-being than people who spend money on things. And so that seems intuitive. We've actually shown that in the research. So somebody who plans a trip, they anticipate that trip. They have the experience of that trip. They probably shared that experience with somebody else. They have the memory of that trip after it's happened, right? So, I mean, they you know, maybe they spent the same amount of money, $1,000 on a new music stereo or $1,000 on a weekend getaway. That $1,000 spent on the weekend getaway theoretically gets you higher well-being than the $1,000 spent on the stereo system. So, you know, those are important things for college students to understand, for all of us to understand, is that it's not necessarily how much money you make, but it's, for example, how you spend that money, your relationship to that money. Those things matter a lot. And we're not taught that much. You know, that's not emphasized to us much. I mean, it is emphasized how much money we make. And that matters to some degree. But like I said, after $75,000 a year in income, not very much.
A lot of this goes to the idea of whether someone, and it can be a person or a college, sort of thrives. And that word thrive has been thrown around a lot in the last year. You have written that as much as 25% of college graduates don't thrive in some way or another. I want to ask you a totally counterintuitive question. If 75% of people are thriving in some way and they outnumber the non-thrivers 3-1, isn't that a fairly good outcome across the board?
Yeah. Well, so in general, so let's take it through the lens of our research, right? This is in particular a study of people who have a college degree. And I think we've made a lot of assumptions, some true, some maybe not true, about what the value of a college degree is, right? We know that you make more money on average over your lifetime with a college degree, those kinds of things. And our data from the Gallup-Purdue Index, interestingly enough, there's five elements of well-being that we measure, right? Not to get into great detail, but they're purpose and social and financial and community and physical. So here's the point. Only about 11% of all college graduates in the U.S. are thriving in all five elements. Now, that's a very high bar, but my point is that almost 9 out of 10 college graduates still have room for improvement in maximizing their well-being, if you will. What's really disappointing, though, is that more than 1 in 6 college graduates aren't thriving in a single one of those elements. So there is zero if you look at all across across those five elements. And I think that's the one that's hard for people to believe, is that these are college graduates. You might believe that statistic if we were talking about the U.S. population as a whole. But in theory, right, we're talking about the best of the best, those who completed a college degree. You know, you would expect that we would, you know, have the vast majority of those folks thriving in at least one element of well-being. In reality, more than one in six are not.
Well, you do have the vast majority thriving. You have 83% or so thriving.
Well, if you look at one of the five elements, right? So, yes, that's true. But if you take it to a higher bar of thriving in three elements or four elements or all five, that's where the percentages start to drop pretty dramatically. And I don't have the expectation that the goal should be that all graduates are thriving in all five elements of well-being. That's a high bar, like I said, but it is interesting to think that there are more than one in six college graduates out there in the U.S. right now who aren't thriving in a single element of well-being, right? And so there's room for improvement on that point. I mean, if universities want to start aiming thoughtfully and intentionally at well-being as an outcome, there's a lot of room for improvement.
You guys are working on Gallup, Indiana as well. You offered this out to all of the schools in the state. How are you doing on getting schools to sign up for that?
It's going well. We're literally in the finalization of that process over the next couple of weeks. And I would say the at least what we've been told, this was organized by the State Higher Ed Commission, and obviously Gallup is helping support the work through the survey. It's going to measure all the key elements that are the part of the Gallup-Purdue Index. It's going to have some additional questions added that get at important outcomes for the state. So an example would be of those graduates who said they had a job or an internship where they applied what they were learning in the classroom, was that with an Indiana employer, for example? It'd be good to know. Does that improve the likelihood that they end up staying in the state later or not? I mean, you know, important questions that I think have some state implications, but we have, at least last count this week, the majority of the public institutions in the state are already signed on to do it and participate, which is great to see. And there may be a good number of the private institutions as well. So we're going to probably know kind of final participation numbers on that by the end of September, so real soon.
Clearly, the private schools outnumber the public schools in Indiana. Is it important in some ways to have those schools included because – you have numbers already from a large public institution like Purdue, and I think it's, speaking as someone who went to a small liberal arts college for undergrad, I deliberately stayed away from the giant university, and I think there are a lot of people who think that way, and if you're getting at different groups of college graduates, is it very important to you to have a broad swath of the small privates included too?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, that we're getting at that through the national study with the Gallup-Purdue Index. I mean, with 30,000 college graduates in there, we can cut that data by all types of institutional types. I mean, you know, small, private, liberal arts, highly residential. I mean, you name it. You give me a Carnegie classification or a way of categorizing a university, we can look at that data through the national data set. But I think for the purposes of the state of Indiana, I think it's very valuable to know how both the public and the private institutions are doing on these measures. I mean, it's valuable for each of those individual institutions for their own understanding and you know, thinking about continuous improvement. But I think it's helpful to students in Indiana who are making decisions about colleges and to have, you know, an idea of, you know, whether or not different types of institutions are actually doing a better job on increasing the likelihood that students get some of these key experiences. But, of course, it goes both ways. You know, the big finding from last year's data was, you know, it's less about the type of institution that you went to and much more about the experiences that you either had or didn't have. And to put it in the student lens, that you either took advantage of or didn't. You know, these things go both ways. I mean, universities need to do more to increase the probability that students get these key experiences. But the students also need to make sure they take advantage of those and even know what are the key experiences to take advantage of? I mean, right now we emphasize GPA, you know, have a really high GPA. And, you know, that's the ticket to a great job. Well, not according to Google, who's stopped asking about GPA and grades because they found no relationship between those things and performance on the job at Google. Now, that's just one employer, but a pretty important and visible one. But, you know, my point is there's a lot of things that make for the probability that someone ends up successful in their work later. And right now, you know, most college students don't have an appreciation for what those things are, and most employers don't either. So there's a lot of opportunity to help both students and then universities and employers understand things that, that really matter in the grand scheme of things.
When you're coming up with questions to ask or the metrics that you want to measure, who decides on those things? Do you come up with them as a testing group? Do you get input from the universities who say, we want to know about topics X, Y, and Z? How does that process work?
We've got this guy called the Wizard of Oz. No, I'm just kidding. There's a lot of different things that are involved in the process. One of course is a team at Gallup that are professionals about asking good questions. That sounds like such a simple thing, but that may be one of the things that we're the best in the world at is asking great questions. So we've had a lot of experience asking questions. We've had experience testing different versions of questions over the years, right? So we do have an understanding from that side of things. But in all these examples of the work we've done, certainly participation from faculty members and administrators at Purdue who've been involved in that, other experts who have been experts in higher education research and workplace outcomes and things like that. I mean, there's, if you think about it, an extensive list of folks who have been consulted in some form with ideas for the questions. And then the questions are always tested, right? We do what we call cognitive interviews, where we sit down and actually read the questions to somebody live and understand whether they understand the question. Was it confusing to them? How did they interpret the question? So I'll give you examples. One of the questions that didn't make it through cognitive interviewing was whether or not a graduate did a thesis. And it turns out that a lot of college graduates don't know what a thesis is, or at least enough didn't know what that was that we couldn't really ask it on a national survey. So instead, a question that did work that would get at whether you did a thesis was whether or not you worked on a long-term project that took a semester or more to complete. Now, we didn't ask about a thesis, but arguably we would be picking up on people who did a thesis through that question. But my point is that, you know, the idea of asking the question about a thesis, not every college graduate knows what a thesis is. And you only learn that by doing cognitive interviews, realizing that some people were confused, didn't know what that term was. So it goes through that type of testing. And then ultimately, you know, the questions we end up fielding in the survey, we look at whether they had relationships with any of the outcomes that we were looking at or not. And we've tested several questions that didn't have any relationship with workplace engagement later, that didn't have a relationship with well-being. And it's not to say they don't matter, but at least on do they have a relationship with those things, the answer was they didn't. So that's the beauty of doing an annual study every year with a fresh representative sample is that we can add new questions every year, test them against some of the, you know, current outcomes that we're looking at and find out whether they have a relationship or not. And so last year, you know, I think we did a great job. We identified, you know, what we call the big six key experiences that have a very powerful relationship with workplace engagement and well-being later. This year we tested two that we thought we had high hopes that would have a relationship with them, and they didn't. So we'll report on those soon, but some of them will be pretty eye-opening for higher ed experiences that a lot of us in higher ed would say matter a lot that we didn't find any relationship with. So
Reason I ask is because I hear you talking about things like student debt load, which I have talked with Mitch Daniels extensively about, and it's clear that this is something that is on his mind, and I'm sure it's on the mind of college presidents the country over. And there are some of them, President Daniels included, who have a very definite feeling about what a student debt load does to a person, whether that's true or not. How do you strip away what might be the ideology behind someone saying, hey, would you ask this question? How do you go about making it as plain vanilla, cut to the data as possible?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of work and effort that goes into that. I mean, you know, anybody who's done polling or survey research knows that, you know, you can change one word in a question that looks very innocuous to the average observer, and it ends up giving you very different answers, right? I mean, for example, Gallup learned this just this past year asking Americans about Common Core. You know, the K-12, you know, public education reform efforts. And, you know, one or two little words will change, you know, majority support for Common Core versus majority opposed to Common Core. And to the typical observer, they'd look at both questions and say, that's the same question. Why are there such differences in the responses, right? So, you know, part of it is, you have to very carefully look at the wording. I think you also have to take it through the lens of the rules that we operate with at Gallup, right? These are our own self-imposed ethics that we're famous for, and that is that, you know, we do not do work for Republican polling firms or lobbyist groups, right? I mean, we're we've actually, you know, been very clear that we don't do that work. We basically make no money on our polling work because we refuse to do work for either Republican or Democratic, you know, leaning organizations. And so we strive to do independent research. So in this partnership with Purdue, it has the unique attribute of Gallup, at the end of the day, having final say on the questions that we ask in the research. And so we've gotten great input from Purdue faculty and the folks that have been part of that process with it. But at the end of the day, we reserve the final right and say over that. And one of the things we strive for is to ask questions that, you know, we think are easily understood and interpreted, questions that are not biased. You can ask questions where 95% of people will agree with it. And I would show you a question that's not a great question. When you see 95% of Americans agreeing with it, it was probably a poorly worded question.
Has that caused any frustration between the Purdue folks and you? Have they really wanted to study something or push an idea and you've said, no, no, we just can't do that?
No, not in particular. I mean, I think we have had many great what you would consider healthy academic debates about, you know, what the research inquiry should be, what questions we should add, questions that both of us attempted to add that didn't, you know, like example I gave, didn't make it through the cognitive interviewing process or whatever. But no, I don't think there's been any huge differences in, you know, well, we should ask this versus this between, you know, Gallup and Purdue. And a lot of it, too, is because there's great consensus nationally on what's important or what we're interested in studying across higher ed, right? I mean, if you were to go around and ask the leaders of all the higher ed associations, right, and you said, what are the top three, you know, most important things? Student loan debt is going to be on that list, right? I mean, so we're also, you know, I think studying the things that are on the top of a lot of people's lists right now, not just Purdue's list or Gallup's list. And, you know, look, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, if we were doing research that was biased in one way or the other, it would have very little utility to people, right? It would be criticized in all kinds of different ways. And I think the one thing that I've been most proud of in terms of my own association with this project is that it has been incredibly well received by folks from all different angles, right, from college presidents to even faculty members, right, who are always, you know, very keen to, you know, pick on the nuances of well done and not well done research. And so I think, you know, we've been validated by lots of very positive responses. And, you know, and we've gotten plenty of tough questions about the research, but we haven't had a lot of, you know, what I would consider strong opposition to it or folks who have said, well, this wasn't done in a you know, high quality fashion. I mean, I think people, the whole country, media included, have looked at it as a very well done research project so far.
And I've read a lot of good press about it myself. And I wonder at the same time, I can't escape the idea that there might be colleges out there who think you're opening Pandora's box here, because for a long time, there's been an informal stratification in our heads of, all right, Harvard is better than the University of Phoenix or something like that. And we don't have to have any numbers that say that's true. We just instinctively know these things. And now, all of a sudden, here's year after year of data and study that's been done on this. And I can't help but wonder if the people who are going to come out on the bottom of this stratification are like, maybe you should stop this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we've certainly raised a lot of questions and kind of honest introspection across higher ed is the way I would say it. You know, I mean, because what we've realized through this research is that things that we maybe only valued a little bit are actually looking like they're incredibly valued, right? Things that we've placed a lot of emphasis on, maybe not as important as we thought, right? I mean, so it is definitely changing people's perceptions about what they value in terms of what's important in a college experience, what's not. You know, we've certainly had, you know, take faculty, right? I mean, you know, I've been in several meetings where we presented findings for a particular school, right, presenting their own alumni results on this. And let's face it, on the Big Six experiences, not many colleges are doing very well on any of those, right? I mean, if you were just looking at the percentages and you go, geez, less than a third of all college graduates in the U.S. strongly agree that they had a project that took a semester or longer to complete. You know, you go, really? It's less than a third? I mean, that one to me seems like that ought to be 100% of all college graduates. How could you possibly graduate without working on a project that took a semester or more to complete? But, you know, so my point is that most leaders and faculty members who look at some of the percentages from their graduates are not happy with what they see. But what they do realize is that they've got plenty of room for improvement, right, that they are being led in a data-driven way to things that might improve outcomes for students and graduates. And, you know, and then if we look honestly at some of those things, I mean, you know, higher ed hasn't put a lot of elbow grease behind, you know, those kinds of things like mentoring. It's just not, it's not something that's been a huge focus of colleges and universities. And yet, you know, students who have mentors that encourage their goals and dreams, it may be one of the most important things for their long-term outcome. So the good news is, even though it's been discomforting to people, right, jolting in some ways, most of the folks that I've talked to, that I've heard from, that I've seen making comments on blogs about it or writing about it, they've been very honest and thoughtful too, which is something I've appreciated, you know. And I think higher ed's at a place where most people have realized that some things need to change in terms of, you know, it's not business as usual in higher ed. There's a lot of forces behind that. It's not just about Gallup Purdue Index research, but, you know, we're certainly, I think, giving people some very helpful research that helps them, you know, point their institution and the people who are part of those institutions in probably some more productive directions.
Well, and it sounds like you're almost looking for everybody to be unhappy with something they find out about themselves.
Well, I mean, to some degree, where does continuous improvement come from, right? I mean, it's not by, you know, seeing yourself at the top of the list and, you know, feeling great about that. I mean, and that's the message I give to most of the universities that hire Gallup to measure their alumni. Is that, you know, be prepared. The results are probably not going to be as good as you think they are. And that's okay, because almost everybody's in the same boat. Yes, we see variation on some of these items by, you know, different institution. So there are some universities doing much better on some of these measures than others. That's definitely the case. But I think in general, it's been received with a healthy realization that we can do better. And even the schools that are at the top of the percentages, you know, they compare favorably against schools nationally, they're still not happy with where they are, right? I mean, you'd be world class if 29% of your graduates said that you had a mentor who encouraged your goals and dreams. I mean, most people look at that and go, 29%? We're going to be happy with 29%? I mean, no, that's, you know, but relatively speaking, you would be world class as a university if 29% of your graduates strongly agreed to that.
All right. Anything else you want to add or stuff that I've missed?
No, it's just it's an incredibly exciting project, and we're at the proverbial tip of the iceberg in what we're learning from it. And even though I think it's already produced a lot of insights and a lot of news and a lot of thoughtful conversation, I mean, I can tell you that there is a long tail on the key insights that's going to come from this, not just year two, but into the future and beyond. And so I can't wait to see what comes.
It's going to be an interesting analogy in the years to come. Who sees the tip of the iceberg and steers away from it, and who winds up the Titanic?
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, you know, there are a lot of folks like Clayton Christensen, the famous Harvard Business School professor who's you know, an expert on disruptive innovation. You know, he's gone on record saying that a large percentage of the colleges and universities in the U.S. are going to go out of business in the next 15 years. And so whether he's right or not, you know, I think people have started to realize that, you know, business as usual is probably not, you know, not the right path forward. So some, you know, like the great brands of Harvard, you know, some people would argue that it doesn't matter what they do. They're still going to have a great brand. People are still going to want to pay for it, want to go there, right? But, you know, as it comes to Gallup Purdue Index findings, those are institutions that in some ways have nothing to gain, or at least they don't think they have anything to gain by looking at graduate outcomes, because everybody assumes that they're doing fantastic. So, you know, I do think there's a category of institution that in a way, you know, could be threatened by what we're learning from this study, you know, in that, you know, prestigious universities don't necessarily have a lock on having more engaged graduates, for example. But they also feel like, you know, they're doing okay because they're, you know, they're who they are, right? They're the brand name. So who knows? I mean, the brand names may never be disrupted, but I actually think I would say that I think that they will be in some fashion or another. People will eventually look very, very carefully at the quality of the experience they're getting, and not just the prestige of the name or the perception of the brand value, but in reality, what are they getting out of it? And as more students and parents get to that place, there will be shifts in how all institutions operate.